Hyperion to a Saturn.
Welcome to the 29th episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene deep dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. Today, we continue our coverage of Act 4 with Scene 4, in which Hamlet encounters Fortinbras's army. Now, despite its containing one of Hamlet's soliloquies, it's not uncommon to see this scene excised from any given adaptation. In fact, this episode might be a bit shorter than others for that reason. Obviously, those that remove Fortinbras entirely won't be able to justify Hamlet crossing paths with his army on his way to exile in England. And a director might legitimately ask if their adaptation needs another moment where Hamlet decides that now he must act. In many ways, this is a mirror of Oh, What a Rogue and Peasant Slave Am I, Act 2, Scene 2. There, he was shamed by the first player whose ability to express a false passion was greater than his to express a true ambition. Here, Hamlet is shamed by Norway and Poland, who attack or defend a worthless patch of soil with more conviction and willful action than he went after his revenge. Fortinbras is, after all, Hamlet's opposite number, a princely man of action. Perhaps far more like Hamlet Sr. than like his scholarly son. In him, Hamlet finds a role model, and perhaps enough of the qualities he would like to see in himself to give the Norwegian prince his vote of confidence at the play's conclusion. But let's look at Shakespeare's text before heading off into the adaptations that did include the scene. Enter Fortinbras, our first look at the Norwegian prince, sending an envoy to Claudius as he crosses his territory. The line, "We shall express our duty in his eye," is perhaps an early clue to Fortinbras's treachery. Expressing his duty in his eye might be something done for appearances only, since his plan is to invade Denmark after the invasion of Poland. As a character introduction, it doesn't tell us much, only recaps the deal he has with Claudius as per the wedding banquet scene. But that's the point. Fortinbras is a plain-spoken man who deals in facts and not abstractions. A doer, not a thinker. At least, not beyond the tactics of the day. Then Hamlet meets that envoy, an army captain, and asks questions about the military campaign. I'm not sure I've ever seen it played that way, but Hamlet's questions could indicate a certain suspicion as to Fortinbras's intent. After all, he's just seen a foreign army on Danish soil. The captain's candor and sincerity, he's like his master, just as Hamlet is a product of his own deceptive court, relieve him of his suspicions, however, as Shakespeare offers a tidy satire on the absurdity of war from the soldier's point of view.
"We go to gain a little patch of ground that hath knit no profit but the name. To pay 5 ducats, 5, I would not farm it. Nor will it yield to Norway or the Pole a rank or rate should it be sold in fee."
"Why, then the Polack never will defend it."
"Yes, it is already garrisoned."
2,000 souls and 20,000 ducats will not debate the question of this straw."
Left alone, when the man takes his leave and his treacherous friends walk ahead a bit, Hamlet has a mid-play soliloquy, "How all occasions do inform against me," in which he asks, again, "What is a man? If his chief good and market of his time be but to sleep and feed, a beast, no more." So Hamlet invokes his earlier quintessence of dust speech, but where earlier he condemned humanity in the general sense, here he more specifically condemns how men abuse other men and render their existence meaningless. He's turned a corner, where before he saw humanity as a futile state of being, now he accepts that humanity is not necessarily futile, but one must throw off the chains of that futility. Relative to the cannon fodder before him, he has power enough to make his life and his death count, and resolves to do so. He even admits God's gift of free will, and thus rejects predestination and nihilism.
"For he that made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability, and godlike reason to fust in us unused. Now, whether it be bestial oblivion or some craven scruple of thinking too precisely on the event, I do not know why, yet I live to say, this thing's to do.
Hamlet counts himself lucky to still be alive, but can't believe he still hasn't done what he set out to do. Hamlet looks into himself and does not know exactly why he's delayed, blaming bestial oblivion. Essentially having forgotten his mission and Claudius's deeds may not seem possible on the surface of it, but his confusion between blaming Claudius and blaming Gertrude might be what he's referring to. The question he asks himself is whether emotion, the realm of the unthinking beast, or reason, thinking himself into inaction, was to blame. Not that it makes any difference. His admiration for Fortinbras takes root here. Admiration for his ability to take risks and action. He hasn't met Fortinbras, of course, so one might suspect Hamlet seeing a bit of himself in him. Certainly, he's the more tender and delicate prince, those epithets that he uses for Fortinbras. Psychologically, Hamlet is actually turning himself into a Fortinbras, readying himself for his eventual return. The speech ends with, "From this time forth, my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worth." Hamlet's tried to convince himself to take action before, but this is the one that takes. When we see him again, he'll have arranged 2 deaths and will be ready to cause more. There really is no going back, though ironically, he's leaving Denmark, so he will have to literally go back. In the Branna adaptation, the frozen lake near Elsinore dissolves into a frozen waste between Denmark's mountains, where figures on horseback appear from out of the mist. Fortinbras, followed by his captain, on their way to Poland. Rufus Sewell's Fortinbras, a so-called tender and delicate prince, seems more like a jaded sociopath with his cold, insincere eyes, and his captain is so curt in his line deliveries, we might well believe he doesn't like his prince, just like he doesn't like his plans.
I will do it, my lord.
If Fortinbras notices, he doesn't care. Wide shots reveal a large marching army, and it's from a certain vantage point that Hamlet will meet the captain and be able to survey the military force walking through his country. The way these shots are designed already evoke Hamlet's exile. Small figures in panoramic white landscapes, and the image will be taken to its extreme at the end. Hamlet isn't grilling the captain in this version, rather more puzzled than irate. Except with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who are kind of flies buzzing at his ears. And he introspectively realizes that wealth and peace breed war by making men like Fortinbras restless to the point of launching capricious forays into other nations in search of glory. When we compare the two princes, we might see Hamlet as a man so preoccupied that he cannot choose the right course of action, whereas Fortinbras lacks any kind of preoccupation, and so must spring into action, any action, to chase the doldrums away. In a presentational twist, Hamlet speaks softly with the captain, but as the music swells behind him and the camera tracks back and back and back, he operatically shouts his soliloquy as if delivering it to an army. And he is an army of one, himself. He is at this moment convincing himself to finally commit to action. There's an interesting discussion between Branagh and his producer in the director's commentary about why so many adaptations cut this speech. They say that many directors see it as redundant. Branagh makes the case that unlike Hamlet's other calls to action, this one is a cooler, more intellectual assessment of why he must do what he must do, and that as such, it is more convincing, a more auto-convincing argument. It's one thing to feel something, but it's another to understand the logic of it. And of course, the dramatic presentation of the speech makes for a better act break than a more intimate moment might otherwise have been, leading to an intermission, as I originally experienced it, or a disc change in bloody red letters, as I now do on DVD. The music is big, the words are large, but the man himself is rendered small in the shot, a single individual, defiant before his destiny, before affairs of state, and before a hostile world. It's the backdrop against which the drama is played. And we see it all. It is Hamlet in scale with the universe of the play, so to speak. And in being smaller, he becomes bigger. Now, Olivier omitted this scene from his 1948 production, so let's move right to the 1980 BBC adaptation. Though the studio-bound production is spare in its scope, the White Plain is a set, Fortinbras's army is a small collection of extras. It reproduces the feel of a stage play, while the scene is still well set, with flags and sound effects that evoke an army on a war footing. A fairly soft war footing, as it turns out, As part of the staging, Fortinbras's last line, "Go softly on," isn't spoken to the captain, but to another soldier staying with the main of the army, as if to evoke a sense of stealthy movement to Fortinbras's troops. They're asking for permission, but perhaps Claudius doesn't know exactly where the army is going or how many men it represents. Fortinbras is definitely hiding something. The conversation between Hamlet and the captain features some of the rare cuts in this adaptation of the play. The Danish prince doesn't ask as many questions and doesn't react out loud to the futility of this war. Sending Rosencrantz and Guildenstern ahead, he turns to the camera or audience, as usual, to speak his soliloquy in quiet and intimate terms. The contrast with Branagh's bombastic call to arms is striking. Jacoby's Hamlet is bitter and rueful, and at once angry and sad he hasn't yet been able to take revenge and lay his father's ghost to rest. Where Branagh motivated his army of one, Jacoby explains and reasons, until only one conclusion can be drawn. His thoughts are now bloody as he looks over to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. That's an implied threat, and one the camera lingers on. We are slow to exit the scene and are meant to understand that these two men, Hamlet's untrustworthy escort, are to become his first victims. And there's a certain sadness in Hamlet that it must be so. In 1990, Zeffirelli omitted the scene, so we jump another decade to Hamlet 2000. You'd think this modern adaptation, with countries represented as corporations, would cut Fortinbras's powers and this scene altogether. And you'd be wrong. Instead of a snowy plane, we're on an airplane. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are sniggering, reading Wired, okay, and eating peanuts in the aisle opposite Hamlet, who is watching in-flight television and looking at postcards that symbolically represent his exile. A plane taking off, a nude painting, a stone mask. We're going back in time to parts unknown, to Hamlet's reptile brain, and away from the civilization and intellectualism that has plagued him to date. On the television is Fortinbras, or so a flight attendant says when Hamlet asks. At least, he looks like a flight attendant, until he puts the drink he's holding in his mouth. Is he then just an officer of some kind? In the play, it's Fortinbras's captain, but here, is he the plane's captain? And if so, he shouldn't be drinking or walking around the craft. It's an odd moment. If I were to give it a purpose, I'd say it's a representation of Norway usurping Hamlet's Danish power. A steward approaches with a drink and then doesn't give it to the passenger, drinks it himself. It foreshadows Fortinbras's corporate takeover. Not that this is in any way clear. And one thing that's missing from the exchange is the idea that soldiers are about to die for a useless cause in Poland. Because we know the play, we might infer it ourselves. But Fortinbras dismantles a Polish company for no other reason than the name, costing untold numbers their jobs. But there's no way to show this with Shakespeare's text, so Hamlet's exhorting examples don't have anything to do with Fortinbras' war. This Hamlet lives in the modern world and is surrounded by examples gross in nature, many of which he's used in his art films. We accept his growing determination without it needing a trigger. The staging is crucial. Hamlet heads for the bathroom at the other end of the plane, speaking his soliloquy as he walks down the aisle. It's an echo of To Be or Not to Be in Blockbuster's aisles. This forces him to walk through economy class, largely empty, a sign of severe class divide, and sees a woman holding a baby. The examples before him, though different than in a play, may still cause his personal call to arms. Seeing other children and other parents only reinforces the unnaturalness of his own family relationships.
I do not know why yet I live to say these things, to do. Sith, I have the cause and means and strength and will to do it. Examples gross as earth exhort me.
The plane seems incredibly long, and the dramatic vanishing point behind Hamlet makes him akin to a bullet in a cannon, about to be fired. In the bathroom, he speaks to himself in the mirror, gives himself a mission. Has he become the ghost himself? He dares himself to act, nose to nose with his reflection, and he will take that dare. The scene is also cut from Fodor's Hamlet. So, all right, let's look at Tennant's. As mentioned last time, it's out of the normal order, after scene 5. Director Gregory Doran introduces it where Hamlet's letter would normally be read as a way to juxtapose its final line, "My thoughts be bloody," with Laertes' own bloody thoughts just before Claudius comes in to seduce him into murdering Hamlet. The modernized staging is interesting, with the camera up above as if Fortinbras and then the captain are looking up at a helicopter, either dropping men off or taking them in. We're still on the same black mirrored stage most of the play is filmed in, but with snow on the ground, contrasting with black soil, and once we change angles, black sky. Hamlet is out in the cold, in darkness, lost. It gives the scene an eerie, dreamlike feel, as if these are spirits come to taunt him in the night. The captain, with his wry barracks humor, smiling contemptuously at the meaningless war he's been asked to fight. Fortinbras, standing in for the ghost of Hamlet's father, a warlike action man, throwing Hamlet's inaction back in his face. But look at what actually happens in the staging of it. Hamlet's first reaction is to sit down and talk.
"Witness this army of such mass and charge, led by a delicate and tender prince, whose spirit with divine ambition puffed, makes mouths at the invisible event, exposing what is mortal and unsure to all that fortune, death, and danger dare. Even for an eggshell. Oh, from this time forth, my thoughts be bloody, or be nothing worth."
The video diary device introduced earlier is here used to justify the soliloquy in which Hamlet, perhaps sarcastically, calls Fortinbras delicate and tender, and ends with the entirely ironic, "My thoughts be bloody, my thoughts." So, while Hamlet seems to be telling us that now he will act, he does not actually move beyond thinking of acting.
"How all occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge. What is a man? His chief good and market of his time be but to sleep."
In Slings and Arrows Play Inside the Show, Luke Kirby's Jack Crew is getting into the home stretch, as this is the last of six soliloquies. What we see of it in the montage is a simple close-up, but it shows how Jack, an insecure Hollywood actor, has become much more confident by this point in the performance, which can also be said of Hamlet. Metatextually, one might very well see how the actor on stage would get an energy boost from knowing his exile, a long overdue break, was up next. The story structure must play into the mood of the actor. But that's not the only metatextual trick Slings and Arrows plays on its audience. As Jack Hamlet speaks his words, his director, Jeffrey, is reminded to get his mentor's skull for the Yorick scene and has to make a mad dash for it. As he does, we stay in touch with Hamlet through the backstage PA system, and the mention of a delicate and tender prince seems to give Jeffrey that association. If Fortinbras is a mirror held up to Hamlet, and Hamlet is an actor-director, taking on various roles and instructing the players on how to act and so on, can Fortinbras be any different? And in that context, the futile enterprise, the eggshell of his war with Poland, is, in a sense, the act of putting on a play. So much goes into the endeavor, and yet each performance is ephemeral. And in the world of the play, it's a ploy to actually attack Denmark, and therefore both as fake as a play, and a mousetrap to catch Claudius. The metatextual juxtaposition made here makes Hamlet chide himself for not giving his all, when the actor who plays him obviously is. The actor is himself the first player, able to conjure emotions out of thin air for a world imaginary. Hamlet keeps breaking that fourth wall and running into himself. A Midwinter's Dream also puts this scene after scene 5 rather than before it. While normally this helps make Hamlet's journey a more involved one, with a meanwhile transition, as it were, here it is more of a question of balancing a montage's tone. In A Midwinter's Dream, or In the Bleak Midwinter, the original title, the play goes by in less than 4 minutes, including some behind-the-scenes comedy. So, after the violence of Laertes' return, and laughs behind the scenes, a few lines from scene 4. With Hamlet wrapped in mist, and an audience wrapped in silent attention. It reminds us of the play's stakes, both on and off the stage. Though the oddballs putting on the play sometimes take it to the level of parody, here we're shown that it does, nevertheless, work.
"What is a man of his chief good and market of his time be but to sleep and feed a beast? No more.
a just reminder that culture, playmaking, play acting, and play going, is where man distinguishes himself from the animals. That is protagonist Joe's belief and intent in the film, and in a way, it's also Shakespeare's, contrasting low violence and high intellectualism in Hamlet's world. As for Classics Illustrated, the original adaptation omits this scene entirely, but the Berkeley version doesn't. Though staging the action just as Hamlet's party leaves Elsinore does have a variety of effects. First, it puts Fortinbras's army very close to the Danish throne, and reinforces the idea that Claudius is a fool to trust Norway. We're looking at a huge army within a stone's throw of what looks like a largely undefended castle, overgrown with weeds and surrounded by crumbling walls. Denmark is on the wane, and artist Tom Mandrake represents this visually. Another change is that the captain's lines seem to have been given to one of Hamlet's guards, which justifies the cursory information given when you do cut most of the captain's lines. Removing the captain's lines about the futility of this particular battle, for example, means Hamlet's condemnation of it as a trick of fame is really a condemnation of all war. He doesn't need to know the details of the Norway-Poland engagement to know many men will die and for what. Their leader's glory and some patch of land? This tells us something about Hamlet's relationship to his father, reputedly a great warrior. He's an academic, and as the play has made clear to date, a man more of words than actions. He sees something of his father in Fortinbras, and that compels him to finally act, but he's also critical of the type of action. Even in a speech about finally committing to action, there's still resistance, an attempt to justify why he might act when others' violence is so distasteful to him. To become one's father or to forge one's own way is in many ways Hamlet's dilemma. Mandrake's active pose in the last panel does a good job of visually representing that leap into a new mode of being for our prince. And well, that ends our look at Act 4, Scene 4. Next time we move right along to Scene 5 and Ophelia's madness. In the meantime, if you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com and leave them there. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope you, dear listener, will return for Scene 5, Part 1, Ophelia's Madness.
The rest is silent.